The Guardian. Hello and welcome to The Guardian Book Club. I'm Claire Armistead, books editor for The Guardian and Observer. This month's guest marks a new departure for the book club. It's the first time we've invited a travel writer. Mind you, Paul Theroux is more than just any old travel writer. He's a novelist, critic and biographer too. But it was his account of travelling all the railways of Europe and Asia that made him famous. The Great Railway Bazaar, published way back in 1975. John Mullen began their conversation with the book's very last sentence. The trip is finished and so is the book, pointing out that it made it sound as if he was writing in real time.
I'll tell you why. My inspiration for this, the writing of this book, was a book by Anthony Trollope called The West Indies and the Spanish Main. In The West Indies and the Spanish Main, Trollope sets off from Southampton and he goes to Jamaica, Trinidad, Cuba, and then to Nicaragua and back. And he says, when he starts, I'm on this ship. I'm beginning this book. And he talks about the voyage. He talks about the ship. Then he talks about being in these places. I don't know whether you know this fact, but Anthony Trollope was a surveyor for the Postal Service. Do you know the red pillar box that you see on the streets? That was designed by Anthony Trollope, the novelist. You know that? Everyone knows
We're talking about an alpha audience here.
Okay, that's great. Okay, so I don't have to explain. But I can tell, how many have read The West Indies and the Spanish Main? No one.
No one, that's...
Okay, great.
Okay. They're alpha, but they're kind of normal too.
Okay, alpha minus. Okay, so it's a wonderful book. I'll tell you why it's a wonderful book. Because it's full of people, it's full of conversations, and it's a book that only a novelist could have written. American Notes, the Dickens book about the States, is similar. He goes and he says, it's full of voices. Trollope went to do a survey of the Postal Service just to see how long it took a letter to get to a certain place on a ship to be opened, to be delivered in Jamaica. And he was just doing a survey. And with his left hand, he was writing this travel book. And he says at the end of the book how every day he wrote his experiences of travel, whether it was Trinidad or Cuba or Jamaica or wherever. And that was the book. And when he arrives back, he says, my book is done. I'm going to bring it to my publisher, and then I'm going to move on and write a novel. So I thought, this is a splendid way to do it. So when I set off on this trip with my heart and my mouth, because I had never written a travel book before, but I had Trollope as an example. I thought, I'm going to set off, and the first line of my trip in my notebook will be the first line of the book, and I'll continue writing in the past tense, but every day there will be an episode. And I was doing something that I don't do anymore, which is I was writing whole pages of dialogue. Nowadays, I just write the other person's responses. I don't write she said or he said, and then I fill in what I said. So writing dialogue and writing descriptions, and then finishing the book, I did have all those notebooks. That was my example. The West Indies and the Spanish Main was recommended to me by V.S. Naipaul, a book that he said was instructive to him.
But you got back and then plonkety-plonk on the typewriter.
Yes.
Some of the time were you just having, therefore, to just literally transcribe?
Yes.
Almost? Yes.
Yes. It's not literally transcribed from the notebooks. It's improved. But because I was scribble, and then typing. But the book had a beginning, middle, and end in the notebooks.
Yeah.
I left a lot out.
Yeah.
But just...
Well, you left a lot out that was in your notebooks.
Yeah, boring stuff.
Yeah.
But being ill, being delayed. A lot of travel is nuisance and delay, and no one wants to read about that, about the amount of time you spent in line waiting for a visa, waiting for a bus, waiting for a train, delay. No one wants to read that. I tried to abbreviate that part. Because I had never written a travel book before, I didn't quite know where I was going with it, but I knew what I didn't want to write. I didn't want to write about museums. I didn't want to write about sightseeing. I wanted to write about what V.S. Pritchard called human architecture. People that I met, conversation, especially voices, and the way people spoke and what they were saying to me, and landscapes, a sense of the landscape passing through the window of the train, people talking. In the introduction to a choice of Kipling's verse, T.S. Eliot says that you really don't understand a place until you smell it. And also, I didn't want it to sound like the travel books that I didn't like, which were the books about husband and wife going to a place and finding it colorful. Yeah. And my wife said this, and the kind of sort of cozy thing. I wanted it to sound new and to put in novelistic elements, yeah. Voices.
If I could ask you about, again, about the sort of the method, the working method of doing that, because what was the way in which you preserved those dialogues when we all know that most of us can't remember anything that was said 10 minutes ago, let alone 10 hours ago, let alone the day before? Were you always running off to quickly copy stuff down? Or?
Yes, you can't remember. And particularly in travel, one experience follows another with such rapidity that unless you make some note of it, it's gone. One of the terrible things that can happen in travel is for you to miss a day or two of keeping up, making your notes. I keep a notebook even now. You know, I mean, I wrote this book in 1973, but I still have a notebook, and I write things down, and yesterday someone said he had the charm that psychopathic people always seem to have. And then a pickup line, someone told me, they were in another country, and a man approached this woman and said, I had a dream in which Jesus told me, you're going to meet someone today, you're going to meet a girl, and it's you. So I have a natural instinct, or a natural impulse, I should say, to write something down if someone says it, not in their presence, but fairly soon after. I've never knowingly shown anyone my pencil or pen. You don't, when you're talking to someone, you never wave this around, you know. You never wave. You keep it in your pocket and say, isn't that fascinating? And then you duck out of sight and write it down. All day, I write things down in a small notebook. I keep it in my pocket. And then in the evening, I write it out more fully while it's still fresh in my mind. But strangely, you know, even at the end of a trip, I sometimes remember, if I have these clues of the notes, I often remember other circumstances of that encounter. But I have the voice. And having a person's own voice, own distinct voice, is very important to me, but can only be preserved, I think, if you keep a notebook. And I can often tell when I read a travel book whether that, you know, sometimes voices don't ring true.
Yeah.
Also, I like the idea of someone telling a story, particularly telling a story on a train. And strangers on trains, strangers who meet, often tell stories. And they tell them in an interesting way. They sort of hold the floor. People have said to me, it's amazing, you meet these people and they have these stories. Why do they tell you these stories? And how does it come about? And I've often said, it's sometimes impossible to shut people up, that most people want to tell a story, and getting people to stop talking is usually the challenge, with some exceptions. I mean, I've recently been traveling in the United States, in the south of the United States, and Americans can be very long-winded, but not candid. In other countries, people in India or China, you know, where do you live, how much do you earn, how many children do you have, where do you work? What are your hopes and dreams? When you ask those, and people answer, and they even say, come to my house, have a cup of tea. I was recently in Alabama and Mississippi. Ask people those questions, and they say, what are you, from the government? What are you writing? What are you, writing a book? You know, I say, yeah, maybe I am. But I should also say that I wrote this book, I took the trip in 1973, but I first began traveling in 1963. So I had been living in Africa, Southeast Asia, and London for 10 years, and the West Country for 10 years before I thought I'm going to write about travel. I always thought I'm a novelist, I'm going to write fiction, and travel is for, it's this other boring thing that I don't really want to do.
And it does seem that traveling in India feels like it gives you particularly rich material. I mean, but there's a kind of sort of complicated chaos about traveling in India and the gradations of types of travel and types of compartment, and perhaps also the fact that, I don't know if it's to do with language as well, that makes it particularly sort of satisfying material. Is that right?
Yes, and also that Indians speak English.
Yes.
And the idea of being in a country where English is spoken in all regions of India, and people, as is of course very candid, Indians speaking English to each other, people from the Punjab talking to someone in Madras, or Chennai as it's called, would be speaking in English because the Punjabi might not know Tamil. That's very helpful. Also, India is a huge, rich country connected to its past, very proud of its heritage and its culture. And it's so easy to travel because there's trains going everywhere. So everything in India contributed to the pleasure of the trip. And then it was as though Indians knew that they were being quoted,
yeah.
and saying, you know, with lessons and so forth. I loved everything about India. I loved the food. I loved meeting the people. I loved the trains. I liked the weather.
Let me ask you about one of the things, which is one of the things which makes it most entertaining and intriguing to read. But perhaps nowadays, perhaps travel writers would be a bit more hesitant to write about it as you do, which is sort of national characteristics,
oh, yeah.
I suppose. And you actually say the railway bazaar with its gadgets and passengers represented the society so completely that to board it was to be challenged by the national character. The going on trains was a way of encountering the national character.
I didn't realize that how different a French train was from a British rail, and a Turkish train was from a French train, or an Iranian train different from a Turkish train, and it did. It was a revelation, and it created, I suppose, a running commentary or on national characteristics. Nowadays, I might be more careful about talking about national characteristics. I mean, you've got to be careful. But at that time, I was breezier on the subject. But it was also true that I didn't really comprehend life in the country or the culture of the country until I got on the train. And then all the artifacts of the way of life, even I mentioned, I think, on the Malaysian train how people were taking a bath and taking a shower from these big jars of water slopping back and forth. And that struck me, too. I mean, that wouldn't be the case now. I must say also, this book is an antique. The trains that I took are antiques. The idea that I was on steam trains a lot of the time. Imagine steam trains in Turkey, steam trains in India, steam trains, all choo-choo, chugging, people shoveling coal. You know, a lot of travel is problem solving. It's how do you get from here to there? You're stuck somewhere, or there's a meal, or whatever it is. How do you eat? How do you live? Where do you find a place to stay? I had no onward bookings. I just knew that I had to be in Japan on a particular day, and it was in December. And I just was showing up or getting off a train and saying, where's the nearest hotel, or is there a hotel?
But the booking, the whole process of booking, you say you cut out the stuff about waiting around. But as everybody here will know, I mean, the business of making bookings and trying to find when a train leaves is kind of one of the running, I mean, again, national characteristics different in every country.
It's very hard to devise a travel book set in North America, which is about the difficulty of getting from one place to another, unless you invent a difficulty. You say, I'm going on a bike, or I'm going with my dog, or I'm going in an old car that breaks down all the time. And then that becomes... F. Scott Fitzgerald wrote such a book about going from Connecticut to Alabama. It's called The Cruise of the Rolling Junk. Henry Miller wrote one called The Air-Conditioned Nightmare about taking driving cross-country. William Lee Sweet Moon, Blue Highways, taking back roads. So they've kind of devised difficulties, whereas I was trying to go the simplest way, they're trying to go the most difficult way. This is in the nature of the old laborious travel and about meeting people along the way. It's about human encounter. I was trying to make it new. I was trying to write a travel book that no one else had written, trying to write my own travel book. So in describing someone, I was breezy. Have any of you been to Arizona, Nogales, Arizona? Nogales, Arizona. No one's been there. All right, I recommend this. Go to Nogales, Arizona. It's in the south. It's on the border. It's south of Tucson. You go to Phoenix, rent a car, drive to Tucson, have a cup of tea, drive to Nogales, park your car. The feature that you'll notice is a fence, a 40-foot steel fence that you can't see through. It goes for miles in that direction and miles in that direction. And it's so high, you can't see over it. But there's a door in it. And it's the door to Nogales, Mexico. So you go and you show your passport to the immigration on the American side, just an officer. He doesn't stamp it. He just looks at it. You open the door and you step on the other side and you're in Mexico. And at the American side, it's fast food and parking lots and swept streets. And you walk across and there's mariachi music, smell of tacos, people walking in cowboy boots. And you're immediately in another country. You walk from one, and it's not 50 feet. You walk 20 feet through a 40-foot fence. You just walk through a door, and you can't see the door, and it's different. I've never had this experience in any other country. Normally, when you're passing through another country, there's plenty of examples of it. Going from Afghanistan into Pakistan, Pakistan into India, there's a slow progress, usually in no man's land. There's not a fence. This experience of border crossings, which is something I learned in this book, is something that has stayed with me, that the most vivid experience that you can have in travel is crossing a border, and particularly on land, on foot.
I think it's time that I gave everybody else a chance. I've got some more questions, but I won't ask them.
You can pick up and speak and so on. So
yes.
you can then identify people in different parts of the world.
I first went to Africa 50 years ago, in 1963, and I lived in the bush in Malawi, and it was called Nyasaland then. I taught in a school, and the nearest town had an Indian shop, and the owner of the shop was Mr. Desai. And most of the shopkeepers in Malawi were Gujaratis. I was there 2 years, then I went to Uganda, and most of the people I knew and the friends I had who were Indians, but East African resident, were Gujaratis. So I picked up a little bit. I can't speak it, but I could greet people. I could say hello, how are you, thank you. And, you know, in Gujarati, I used to like onions on a curry. The word for onion in Gujarati is dongri che. I will say that one of the things that stood me in good stead in the Great Railway Bazaar, loneliness was a fact, being solitary. But I had lived in remote parts of Africa and had to be self-sufficient. My training for this was twofold. One was living in Africa, and the other factor that stood me in good stead with this book was coming from a large family. I come from a family of 7 children. If you come from a large family, you need to negotiate. You're used to dealing with a lot of different conflicting demands, and you need to be polite. And an only child, a single child, doesn't need to negotiate. If there's a biscuit on the plate, he or she takes it. If there's in 7 children, if there's a biscuit on the plate, you say, "Do you want that?" "No, I don't think so." "Are you sure you don't? Do you want it?" And you always, you want it, but you don't want to be seen to be the one who takes it.
Does the attitude towards the British imperial times change when you speak to your fellow Indian travellers about the railways, that this perhaps is a gift?
India is India because of the railway. I mean, India is a unified country where people can travel, see families, do business, and ship freight and whatever, and for people to live lives because of the railway. Indians know that the railway was planned by the British Raj. And that throughout history, I mean, that the literature of India is intertwined with the railway. I think anyone would acknowledge that. And if you have you been, who has been to Bombay or Mumbai? Is it so? Lots of people. So you've seen this glorious railway station. Yeah, it's incredible. It looks like a great cathedral and Victoria Terminus, let's call it. And all the railway stations throughout India have this imperial beauty, and built at great expense, and they weren't this sort of sleek, functional little boxes. They, you know, they had soaring, you know, gargoyles on them, and I don't know, flying buttresses and whatever.
Yeah, it's very. It's a, when you're talking about Vietnam in the book, you say something like, I paraphrase, and forgive me if I'm slightly inaccurate, but you say something like that American imperialism, colonialism, whatever you want to call it in Vietnam, is sort of bafflingly sort of careless and superficial, that proper imperialists go and to build amazing things.
Hanoi looks like a suburb of Paris. It has boulevards and beautiful houses and railway stations and whatever. We were in Vietnam for 10 years and left nothing behind but Agent Orange and landmines and, you know, and a tortured population. But there were no airfields, no railway stations, nothing. Even the roads were blown up. So there's no... I don't know whether you're aware of this, but I took this trip again in 2007, and I left London, I went to Paris, I went to Istanbul, and I went as far as I could go, insofar as it was possible to retrace my steps. So there's a sequel to this book that was written 30-odd years later called Ghost Train to the Eastern Star. And in Ghost Train, I went back and revisited many of the scenes of the Railway Bazaar, including... In Upper Burma, I visited that hotel, the guest house in Mamio, and I met a man, a young man, and I said, I'd like to check in. And I said, I've been here before. And he said, are you Paul Theroux? And I said, yeah. And he said, you met my father. And his father had read this book, and as a result of the Railway Bazaar, lots of people went, and they said, Mr. Bernard, who was Catholic, he ran this the guest house, and they sort of beat a path through his jaw. The backpackers went, and he said, more or less, you put my father on the map. He was so happy. He had a lot of children, and his son was running the same outfit. And he said, what are you doing? I said, I'm writing another book. You know, I'll put you in this book. So it's called Ghost Train. Anyway, there's a Penguin paperback of it. But so revisiting these places was also one of the pleasures of taking the trip again. And also on this trip, I made friends. I made a number of friends that I stayed in touch with and saw over the years. I mean, saw them into their old age. And the one at the beginning, Molesworth, he was called Terry Plunkett Green. There was Mr. Bodwaj. He was in Simla. I stayed in touch with him. He had children. I stayed in touch with the children. They came to London. So the process of making friends, and also in Vietnam, the war was still sort of going on. And when I revisited, the war was over, and people were rebuilding. They were prosperous, and they were without any rancor. They said, "Your government did it. This is a new era that we're in." They didn't have any ill will toward me as an American, although we had destroyed their country.
Paul, I seem to remember you saying somewhere that you don't take photographs when you're travelling. And from what you were saying about the speed of travel and how hard it is to take everything in, wouldn't it be useful as a like reference material to take photographs? So, you know, you're having to remember the conversation and also the shirt and the jacket and the environment.
Okay, that's an excellent question. And the answer is no, because... If you take pictures, you tend not to look very hard at the thing that you're taking a picture of. If you don't take pictures, you look very hard, and you remember much more of the experience of what you're looking at. So that I actually did have a camera on this trip because it was my first travel book, and I thought maybe there'll be some pictures. So I have quite a few pictures. Black and white. Little color slides is what I have mainly of the trip. I have used them in the past. They're not very good pictures. But the short answer is, if you take pictures, you lose your concentration. And it's just as though if you have a tape recorder, something switches off in your head, and you really stop listening to the person. You're trying to think of your next question. If you have a tape recorder, you think, well, I've got it all on tape. So all I have to do is ask questions. If you don't have a tape recorder, you're intensely aware of what a person is saying, and you're remembering it. If you have a camera, you think, I don't have to... As you say, it becomes an aid memoir, so you take pictures. But a picture isn't really the way to remember something, the way to remember it is to meditate on it or to observe it intensely, and then you remember. I think that taking a picture is almost a way of forgetting a thing.
The notebooks seem to me to be paramount, the first draft. Another book that I'm reading now is called The Seven Pillars of Wisdom. And T.E. Lawrence lost his notebooks and the first draft on a railway station in Reading and then had to start all again. Has that ever happened to you?
No, it's never happened. When you write things down, what you're saying is absolutely true, that if you're always dealing with a handwritten manuscript, and I write fiction. I recommend my last novel to you. It's called The Lower River. I write it in longhand, from first to last. I write it usually in a rough draft, and then I write it. So at the end of a book, I don't type it as I go, because typing is a very final process. So I write it, rewrite it, cross things out. So I have a manuscript that looks like any manuscript, scribbled manuscript. The problem is, what if you lose it? Carson McCullers left a copy of her first book on a train in New York. There are other examples.
John Stuart Mill used Carlyle's History of the French Revolution, or his maid used it to light a fire.
But what I do is I make photocopies of it, you know, to put you out of your misery. I don't. So when I have, say, with a handwritten manuscript, if I'm home writing and I have 20 pages, I photocopy it and put it in a safe place. So I have a photocopy of whatever I write in longhand. And one of the great benefits of a computer, of course, is that you type it and then you have a copy. However, when I wrote the first chapter of the book that has just appeared, The Last Train to Zona Verde, I wrote the first chapter, and then I started the second chapter, and I thought, I'm going to retitle the first chapter. And it said, do you want to relabel this document? Yes, I did want to relabel the document. I relabeled it. And are you sure you want to relabel it? Yeah. I relabeled it.
We all have.
It was 5,000 words, and it was gone. Gone.
Mm-hmm. I was just wondering, with 50 years of travel and writing and experience under your belt now, what advice would you give a young Paul Theroux first starting out on his first travel book?
I would say leave home, go to a place where people are sort of advising you not to go, or you know, go stay off the beaten track. Don't phone home every day. Just disappear. Be unconnected to the past, to the family, to your friends. Just go and tell the truth about what you see, in spite of the fact that people, you know, people have said to me that in 1986 and 87, I was in China and I published a book called Riding the Iron Rooster. It got very, very rude treatment in the press because people were saying, how can you say that the Chinese are reforming and all you're doing is writing about how the police are oppressing them and the government's severe? And I said, well, that's what I saw. If you write the truth, the book will be far more interesting than if you're, you know, embroidering. And the other thing is that writing the truth is prophetic. When the book was published in 88, I got these breezy reviews and people saying, you know, you're grouchy, you're negative. But then in 1989, in June, there was Tiananmen Square. And what happened in Tiananmen Square was what I had been seeing without understanding it in rural China, in Xinjiang. And there was a man called Fang Lijie, professor, he was a physics professor, who had a democracy movement. And I didn't know what I was seeing, but I was just writing down the voices, the experiences that I had, and the attitudes, particularly the government. The police were very severe, and I met a couple of government people, cultural minister, people that had been recommended to me, and they were very tough. And I thought, well, these are very inflexible people. And so when no one knows how many people were killed in Tiananmen Square, but my book suddenly looked prescient. It was only because I was writing what I saw.
And I think I need to wind it up now because he's very generous with his answers. I'm sure we could keep him here for hours, but we need to liberate him and to liberate you. And thank you very much for coming and for your questions.
Thank you. Thanks.
more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.